listening to Coast Community Radio After Deadline. I'm your host, Chelsea Goro, with The Daily Historian. Today, our guest is Astoria's Deputy Police Chief Brad Johnston, who joins us to discuss driving under the influence of intoxicant cases, a hot topic among city leaders. Welcome, Brad.
Hi, Chelsea.
City leaders and leaders of the court, namely the district attorney, have been engaged in a battle for control of DUIIs for nearly 2 years. But the Astoria Police Department has stayed neutral, just doing their job. But before we get to that, Brad, tell me a little bit about yourself. How long have you served the Astoria Police Department, and what has the road to the deputy chief been like?
Well, I started with Astoria back in October 1992. They hired me on a grant, actually, to fund a DUI enforcement officer. So Astoria has been paying attention to DUIs for a while now, and they trained me, and I started work as a patrol officer, worked some shifts as that DUI enforcement officer. I was appointed as a detective, which was a rotating position at the time, and served as a detective for a couple of years, doing major crimes for the Astoria Police Department, and then was promoted to sergeant, and was a sergeant for a dozen years or so before being promoted to deputy chief.
What are some of the biggest issues that you think are facing the city of Astoria, and how has that shifted over the years?
Like all municipalities, we really do struggle with our budget at this point, and we have so many more things that we'd like to do to be of service to our community, and we're really kind of restricted by the amount of budget that we have. For the police department, that means the inability to fund some positions that we'd really like to fund, such as a second detective, a narcotics investigator, and some of those things that we believe would really affect public safety in a positive way. But for the city at large, we try to be many things for many people. We've got a lot of parks in this town. We've got a great library system. And the city in general is just providing a pretty high level of services, I think, to the community.
What has changed as far as technology since you became a police officer?
When I started with the Astoria Police Department, we had one personal computer in the department. It was an old 286 for the geeks out there. Didn't have much in the way of capabilities. We had a mainframe system that was the repository for most of our records. That actually crashed back in about 1998 and kind of led to a pretty large change in the way we kept records and the way we dispatched. When I started the cars, we had no technology in the cars other than a radar unit. And now we've got mobile data terminals in the car. We've got handheld ticket writers in the car. We've got any numbers of ways that the officer in the field has access to technology to make their job better.
Have you seen a shift in focus onto DUIIs, or do you think they've always been a prevalent issue?
You know, in Astoria, it's been a pretty prevalent area for a long time. Like I said, I was actually hired on a grant that was focusing on DUI enforcement. And we have put a pretty high level of training into our officers that are so that they're competent in dealing with DUI cases, because DUI cases are really a case where you're required to gather a lot of evidence in a very short time, and that evidence dissipates over time. And there's a lot of case law involving them that's constantly shifting. So it is a difficult case to prosecute. We've focused on it. We've always, in my tenure, we've always had somebody that's on staff trained for teaching people how to test people for DUIIs. We have a drug recognition expert right now, and actually a drug recognition instructor on the force right now. And so we've been paying attention to it for a while now.
Okay. The city received word last month from Marion County Circuit Court Judge Alvin Norblad that he had reached a decision in the battle for control of DUII cases between the city of Astoria and the district attorney. The Oregon Department of Justice is responsible for drafting up that judgment that will be signed by City Attorney Blair Henningsgaard this week, pending agreement on the language. Norblad ruled that District Attorney Josh Marquis can prosecute the cases, but the biggest issue the two parties are facing is a disagreement on where he will do that in municipal or circuit court. In your opinion, what is the police department's position on where the cases will go? Does it matter to you, or are you simply just waiting for some direction either way?
The department is neutral on the matter. We will cite where we are directed to cite them, and we will assist in the prosecution as vigorously as we can. There's a fair amount of separation between the courts and the prosecutors and the police, and I think that's for some very wise ethical reasons. We will continue to cite DUIs as assertively as we can. We will cite them into the court. We're directed to do so.
You're listening to Coast Community Radio After Deadline with our guest, Astoria's Deputy Police Chief Brad Johnston. Today we're talking about driving under the influence of intoxicant cases. Brad, can you explain the department's current policy on DUIs and where they are cited?
Right now on most misdemeanors, we cite into the Astoria Municipal Court. And misdemeanors are those crimes that are punishable by less than 1 year in jail. There are some exceptions to that where domestic violence cases and others we will cite into circuit court where we have a policy that says that. But we do have a policy that does not leave much up to the officer's discretion, and that's for a very intentional reason. We want people to be prosecuted equally and based on the incidence of that particular arrest and not on who they are or what they do or any of those things. So right now, that means that most DUIs are cited into Astoria Municipal Court. The exceptions to that are people who are habitual or have several convictions for driving under the influence of intoxicants that would subject them to felony penalties, or a person who has a minor in the car with them while they are driving under the influence of intoxicants.
Last week, the Astoria Police Department arrested their first drunk driver since Judge Norblad's ruling. It was cited into Astoria Municipal Court. What do you think will happen with that case?
You know, that's one I would let to the lawyers to argue about. We've cited it into the appropriate venue, and what happens to it then, you know, we will certainly cooperate with any prosecution on it, but that is for the lawyers to determine and not for the police department.
Is it protected in a sense from changes since it happened pre-judgment signing?
I would again refer you to the lawyers on that. They have lots of thick law books that they can go to and refer to that I'm sure they'll come up with a very good decision on it.
The recent death of 29-year-old veteran James Carpenter on West Marine Drive when alleged drunk driver David Gutman hit a telephone pole, sending Carpenter out of the car, is an example of how serious and tragic driving under the influence of intoxicant cases can be. How does the police department deal with being proactive on preventing drunk drivers?
We've been very aggressive in pursuing grants that will fund extra shifts for DUI enforcement officers. That allows us to focus our enforcement efforts where we think that there's likely to be a high incidence of DUI drivers. And that would be, you know, we tend to spend probably 80% of that money between June and September. It's focusing on festivals and holidays and different events that are occurring in our community that may have a higher incidence of DUI drivers.
Do you have any advice for drivers out there?
You know, my best advice that I always give to people is that making a plan in advance is the best thing to do, because after you've started drinking is a really bad time to make your decisions on how you're getting home, how you're getting to the next place you're going, or any of those things. Making those decisions in advance and, you know, deciding to either take a cab or have a designated driver is by far the best way to go.
Now, bringing drug drivers into the picture, can you explain to me how the proposed hemp festival planned for the end of August is coming along?
You know, that's a very good question. I was listening to some other news coverage this morning and some things that I had been told and that the city council had been told don't appear to actually be quite true as to the venue of the event. So how it's coming along is a very good question. I have not heard from the organizers of the event for about 3 weeks now.
So what's the police department's role and involvement with that?
We kind of take the lead for the city permitting on the event and try to help people through their planning of an event. You know, taking the hemp festival out of it and looking at something like the Goonies Festival from last year, 2 years ago now. We were involved at a fairly early point in that and helped people from the chamber and other community members that were trying to plan that event come up with some ways to mitigate traffic impacts and keep people safe. And we really just kind of try to make sure they have a plan, make sure the plan does not impact other people in a negative way as much as possible, and really look at it from safety aspects as opposed to a political aspect or whether the event's a good idea or those things.
Now, how has the Hemp Festival been described to you? What is it going to include?
The description has changed since its first inception. When I first talked to them, about 30 minutes into the conversation, where we'd been talking about a celebration of hemp and the uses of hemp, I finally asked the question as to whether there was going to be marijuana involved in it or if this was just a hemp festival. And at that point, the organizers actually wanted to have a dosing tent and a place where vendors could actually sell medicinal marijuana to cardholders. We were pretty clear up front that that is not something that's lawful activity and that we would never allow that to be permitted through the city. Since that time, it's changed. The recent iteration that we've been told is a free speech event and concert, and that's really where it stands right now. We don't have a lot of details on it other than there's going to be a paid concert on the Sunday night and other lesser concerts during the day on Sunday and all day Saturday.
So what are some of your concerns?
Well, my biggest concern is the fact that it's Hood to Coast weekend. Hood to Coast drops about 60,000 people into our community. And really, those of us that have lived in the area for a while know that Hood to Coast weekend uses most of the capacity of our roads, our restaurants, our hotels, and of other resources in the community. There's not much left over after they're done. And for an event the size of what's proposed for the Hemp Festival, we would need to hire off-duty officers from other agencies. And those agencies just don't have officers available anymore after they've staffed the Hood to Coast events. So that's one of those concerns. Then you have the traffic in and out and the fact that you know, here we are, our roads are already over capacity, and now we're going to add another 10,000 people estimated in there that are going to be bringing probably another 6,000 cars with them. And just the ability to get people to and from places and keep them safe for that weekend seems to be pushed beyond what we think is reasonable.
Are you concerned that tickets are already being sold for the Ziggy Marley concert?
It seems irresponsible to me to sell tickets in advance of any permission. Listening to the recordings from the Port Commission meeting last night, it doesn't sound like they even have their venue locked up, and it just seems a little premature.
Now, if the concert happened anyway without permission, what would happen then?
We would stop the concert from going on if they had no permits, because especially for the concert itself, makes it pretty clear they'd need a sound amplification permit. And there are other issues that the city would have that they permit. We would have to make it stop without it being permitted.
Now, are there certain date deadlines that they have to meet to get a permit?
We have a 60-day in advance of the event deadline that they'd have to meet, and I think that's about 11 days from now.
Okay. Are you concerned that participants in the festival will use drugs anyway?
It seems clear to me that they probably will. The focus of the event is not hemp. The focus of the event seems to be marijuana. The people that are organizing it have an agenda in mind, and that agenda involves the use of marijuana. And I was just looking at the event's website today, and their rules and regulations are ambiguous as possible as to marijuana use, and it seems to me that while not tacitly approving it, they certainly are wink-wink at it as they talk about it.
Are you concerned that participants in the festival will drive throughout the city under the influence when the event is over?
Yes.
Does having a medical marijuana card protect you from getting a DUI?
It's really the same situation as having a prescription for another controlled substance. Having a drug, whatever that drug is, prescribed to you does not excuse you from impairment while operating a motor vehicle. We would pursue it whether it was a medical marijuana card or a prescription for Vicodin. Both are unlawful if you're impaired to a perceptible degree in operating a motor vehicle.
To shift gears for a moment, the recent threat of bombings in the city of Astoria sparked quite a lot of public discussion on our website particularly. Can you tell me what happened?
We received a fairly long phone call from a subject who was a self-proclaimed terrorist. And in that call, he named several locations where he said there were 40 bombs throughout the town. We went to those locations, worked with the owners of those locations, or in the case of the Coast Guard, with the Coast Guard officials, and looked to see if we could find anything that looked out of place, looked suspicious, and were unable to find anything that gave us any pause as to there being a bomb present. We continue to investigate it. We're working with federal officials as well, trying to see if we can isolate who that person was. But at this point, it appears to be nothing more than a hoax.
Okay. Are there any people of interest?
At this point, there's no details that we're actually releasing on the event.
Okay. Aside from fighting crime, the police department is dealing with its own projects, too, currently in the Yacht Club, while the public safety building undergoes a makeover. Can you explain to me what some of those changes will be?
Well, the makeover at the police department is substantially a seismic upgrade. We are trying to ensure that the police department will be able to function for immediate occupancy after a seismic event, which means that while we'd have to leave the building during a seismic event, or an earthquake, we'd be able to come right back in after the ground stopped shaking and resume work. That's the primary focus of it, and most of that is funded by a $1.5 million grant that we got from the state's emergency management. That will also be accompanied by work that does a little space reorganization and some refreshing as far as technology goes in the building. It's a fairly ambitious project. It does require us to be out of the building while it's being done, because there's no room in the building that won't be affected by it in some way, whether it's just wiring down the overhead utilities or actually removing walls, exterior walls, and pushing them out, or the ceiling. The roof has to be replaced so that it is actually tied onto the building instead of just resting on top of the building and those kind of things. So it's fairly substantial. We won't end up with a Taj Mahal at the end of it. We'll end up with a very sturdy building that we'll be able to stay in and work in case of an emergency.
Is there anything else new with the department?
I guess one of the newest things that we're facing right now is we're just getting ready to start a new technology initiative where we will be replacing the personal computers in the cars with a tablet. We're going to be putting iPads in the cars and using those for our mobile data terminals as opposed to computers. And I think that's we're one of the first agencies actually to try such a thing. And it's kind of interesting. It's going to be a good experiment. If it works out as well as we anticipate it does, it's going to save a fair amount of money. We are able to buy and issue personal computers to the entire department for about the cost of two ruggedized laptops that we were using in the cars. So the cost to upgrade that technology is much less. The cost to keep it refreshed, the cost to repair it should go down quite a bit, and the functionality should go up quite a bit. So it's a pretty exciting project for us to take on.
Is there any training associated with that?
We are going to be trying to bring along everybody to make sure that they're comfortable with the technology, making sure that, you know, we don't just hand them a tablet and say, go forth and compute. We're trying to make sure that they're comfortable with it so that they'll use it, because the more they use it, the more effective they'll be.
And until then, how's the Yacht Club working out?
You know, I love the Yacht Club, actually. I have a much nicer office at the Yacht Club. I have a view of the bay. We have eagles flying overhead. I'm not sure I really want to go back.
Detective Andrew Randall recently got some new accolades. Can you comment on his achievements?
We sent Detective Randall to the Force Science Certification Course, which is a fairly revolutionary training for American law enforcement. It is a training wing of a research wing out of the I believe it's the University of Mankato, and they are taking some very good scientific looks at the use of force incidents and making sure that they understand that whole human interaction and the way people interact. And it's kind of changing some of the paradigms that we have on some of the things where we thought we knew what we were doing and why people were doing things, and giving us a little more information into how that use of force incident really does break down and how quickly it happens, and what those reactions really are to stress and to different stimuli that people will see in that. It's taught by a very multidisciplinary cadre of instructors. There are psychiatrists and attorneys and professors and anthropologists and a little bit of everybody. They're kind of bringing science into the use of force arena and trying to bring the understanding of how those incidents really do work. So we're pretty proud of sending Andrew to that. He will be a great asset to us. You know, as we, for example, with the shooting that we had at the Lamplighter Hotel, having somebody on the major crime team with that level of understanding of the use of force, and whether it's a law enforcement shooting or even a homicide that he's responding to, it will just add a whole lot to our community.
Now, is there anything new with the investigation at the Lamplighter shooting?
You know, I think that probably soon we'll be able to discuss some of the facts about what happened and maybe release some more information. We are still waiting on some information from the labs that did the diagramming of it, and some of those issues that we're waiting on that information so that we can do our internal review. And it has been longer than we would have liked to get to that, but we want to make sure that we have a thorough basis of knowledge prior to actually starting that. And once we complete that review, I think we'll probably come out and lay out a pretty specific timeline of what happened and what the officers saw and what they did in reaction to what they were presented with.
Now, for our listeners, could you kind of recap what had happened that has been released?
Well, in February, our officers responded to the Lamplighter Hotel. They were returning to contact a subject that the hotel had called about earlier. The officers responded, and within a few moments of their responding, ended up firing at the suspect who had answered the door. He was struck at least twice and then got into his car and drove off as the officers were seeking cover. He led officers on a fairly high-speed pursuit. I believe the speeds were in excess of 100 miles an hour between here and Highway 26, where he was both we deployed spike strips on him, and the sheriff's office actually performed a pursuit intervention technique and stopped him and took him into custody. And Mr. Svinsky was taken to the hospital in the Portland area and then lodged at the Clatsop County Jail.
Now, is there anything new on the investigation into the DUI that killed James Carpenter?
I have not actually talked to the investigators for a couple of days on that, and I'm not aware of anything really new on that. It's a very tragic case, and the connections to the community are deep on that one.
Is there any sort of lesson you feel that people should get out of that?
You know, it's another demonstration of the tragedies that come from operating a vehicle under the influence of intoxicants or any impairment. I mean, it could be sleepy driving even. You know, those tragedies just keep coming up in our lives, and it's just one more good example of, you know, having that plan at the beginning of your night on how you're getting home, and not getting into a car with impaired drivers, not driving a car while you're impaired, but having a plan for how you're going to get home.
All right. Is there anything else you'd like to add today?
Not that I can think of today.
Thank you, Deputy Chief Brad Johnston, for joining us. This is Chelsea Gorrell from the Daily Historian for Coast Community Radio After Deadline.